And those of you who live in Salt Lake have probably read and heard a lot about the Danzigs and some of the things they've gone through in recapturing their authentic life. And so without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to them.
It wasn't until last night. It's been several years, but we are once again doing music and the spoken word.
So, from the shadows of the everlasting hills,
we greet you. Yeah. Anyway, so we're hoping this mic scenario will work out. If you can't hear, just move up closer. We're pretty loud mouthed anyway. So, we're going to start you off with a little song, and then we'll tell you a little about ourselves. And we discovered, interestingly enough, yesterday when we read the Tribune that we'd written a book. Entitled, whatever this is called, Orchestrating Our Way to an Authentic Life. The title was very nicely supplied by Sue. My choice for a title was Gay Witch Hunt Turns Up Straight Couple. But can you hear the banjo out there? Okay. Well, let's get started. Raspberry Pi, Huckleberry Pudding, gave them all away for to catch Sally Gooden. Had a little gal named Sally Gooden, I had her to marry me and then she wouldn't. Left piece by left old pudding, ran across the mountain for to catch Sally Gooden. Went from blind to blind, money slipping and sliding, so I can't stand steady. Up the mountain, merry little Sally, raised corn on the hill and devil in the valley.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
Yes, indeed. You know, all the years we were playing in the orchestra at Temple Square, I had this dream of playing banjo with them. And then when they finally had a banjo part, I got snubbed. I was so disappointed.
And that's the real reason that he caused so much trouble. Never mess with a banjo player.
It's just petty vindictiveness.
Well, a little background. We actually were in the same first grade class. We grew up in the same ward. In Salt Lake and Avenues, Temple Square is actually in our stake. So grew up right in the heart of Zion. All of our parents are returned missionaries. My dreams in life were to be on seminary council, which I did, go to BYU, which I did, go on a mission, and get married in the temple, and be a mother in Zion. And I had other dreams, but I squashed them down, because I was kind of a feminist. I had 5 brothers, and it was irritating to see how they'd get so much attention and scouting and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I was supposed to honor it. So I was really a good Mormon. I was good at it.
Yeah, well, and pretty much the same on my caffeine. I wasn't sure what that was, but I knew there were these drinks you had to stay away from. My father was a head of maintenance when I was young at the little Cottonwood vault that the church owns. My mother was manager of Mormon Handicraft for years and years. My father, though, was a convert to the church from Judaism, and so we had this, I guess, unpleasant habit of asking questions, but I never realized what a problem that was till I got out on a mission and everyone got mad at me. But. You know, that first song we played, I really love. It's about this guy chasing down the girl he's after. And Mary and I had a long courtship for Mormons. That's maybe the one thing that's not terribly Mormon about us. 4 years. It took me 4 years to chase her down. And her family has some, they're extreme word of wisdom followers. So that little verse about giving up the food, that was true. I had to give up sugar to date Mary. But eventually she acquiesced to marry me. So I was grateful. So, I actually, here's the frightening part. I had a revelation to marry her, and she didn't believe me.
It's a little freaky when someone tells you this kind of thing. So, 4 years. And my mom who didn't believe in sugar, also had a revelation. So, yeah. That's why it took me 4 years, because I was a little scared.
I wasn't very pushy. I was just persistent. So,
we're going to talk about how you went wrong.
Okay, sorry. We're just going to kind of ramble through our story here. I'm sure we'll leave out some details that some of you are interested in, but there'll be question time afterwards.
Put some
afterwards.
In that you're not interested in at all.
Yeah, we'll put in the... a lot of people ask me, how did your journey go? And my goal in life was to be a seminary teacher. That was my dream. My father had instilled in me a real love of theology. Being Jewish, he had a mind that really could do amazing things with Scripture. And so I grew up with all of this and thought, I have just this great capacity to work with all of these things, and I want to share it with other people. It didn't turn out to happen. My father had a really horrible experience working for the church, and we're pretty sure he ended up on a blacklist for church security or something. So I was offered a seminary teaching position, and then at the last minute it was pulled. In the back of my mind, I kind of had this thought that, I don't know if it's true, but this could have something to do with my dad and the trouble he had. So I never really pursued it after that, because I just thought I had put everything I had into it. So we were musicians for a while, and then I thought, I'm not sure we can support our family with these kids coming on a musician's budget. So I thought, what could I do instead? And I decided to become a social worker, which is, be a folk musician, make hundreds of dollars, be a social worker, make hundreds or less. So. But I got into school, and I was really, I still hadn't lost my passion for incorporating religion, so I really wanted to find a position where I could incorporate spirituality into social work. So for my second year practicum, I just pushed and pushed. I wanted to be at LDS Family Services, and the tricky thing for me, though, is at the same time, I was realizing that at some point, a client was going to come to me and say, I have this problem, I'm gay. And I tend to be very visual, and I visualized myself in that position, and I realized that if that happened to me right away, I was going to have my own crisis, because I didn't know what to do. So I started reading everything I could find, and I was really horrified, because for the first time in my life, I realized something's wrong. The church is wrong about this. They don't have up-to-date information. The things they're saying about why people behave this way are wrong. And that really worried me. I think it really worried Mary when I came home and started chatting with her about it.
Yeah. He was questioning things.
So I'm kind of embarrassed to say, but all this history stuff, I actually knew most of this troubling history pieces beforehand and had just had skillful teachers at Institute and my own wonderful mind find a way around all of it. But as I began to really face the fact that here's something incredibly important, incredibly relevant, and we have no revelation on it, I got really disturbed. I already knew the Book of Mormon couldn't have been a literal translation because there's just no way to literally translate the King James Version out of plates. And so I was out walking my dog one evening and thinking about all of this, and I felt like I'd been my whole life trying to put a puzzle together, and I was so close, and yet at the same time, it just never quite worked out, and I always felt like it was my fault. And that evening, I just kind of noticed one piece was stuck down, and I pried up that piece and discovered that the puzzle fit together perfectly and simply, and that it didn't have the straight edges I'd thought. It sort of went off into mystery, but that it was beautiful and that it was simple and it was easy to understand, and that it wasn't the picture I had been told it was, and that I thought, oh my gosh, the church isn't true. That was the last piece I had to pry up. And then I thought, this huge wave of relief flooded over me, because I had been afraid of dying without doing my best my whole life. I thought, I'm free, and when I die, I'll be okay. Whatever happens, if the worst that could happen is I won't be. And then my third thought was, oh my gosh, Mary's gonna kill me.
That was an accurate concern.
I mean, going through all this, I had struggled for years with, I had a terrible anxiety disorder. I was very frightened, and I grew up very sheltered Mormon, and so I remember being frightened to travel outside of Utah because of all those scary non-Mormons out there. I'd spent most of my life frightened, and finally I realized there was nothing really to be afraid of. It was incredibly liberating for me. And is there anything you want to add to that while you're switching out for we?
Well, when Peter, you know, after he had his revelation that it wasn't true, the next couple weeks I was like, what's up with him? He was happier than I'd ever seen him. He was so helpful with the kids. Like, I mean, he was always a great guy, but all of a sudden he just was better than he'd ever been. I'm like, what's up? You know, you're just so awesome. And then one night he sat me down and he's like, well, you know, it's because I realize that the church isn't true. And that didn't make any sense to me whatsoever, because we all know what happens when you realize the church isn't true. It means Satan's in your life, and you're going to start drinking obsessively and probably commit adultery. And I was horrified. And
those ideas hadn't occurred to me yet, but
I did not handle it well. I guess I would say I was really horrible. I remember just sinking to the floor in our kitchen and just sobbing and kind of curling up in a fetal position and thinking that my life was over, because all the things that mattered, all the things that were supposed to matter, were now in question. And I was devastated.
Which is a difficult thing to deal with as a husband, watching someone else suffer. And yet there was nothing I could do about it. For the first time in my life, I felt really free, really alive. And for the first time I could remember in my life, I wasn't afraid of dying, which was a startling thing for me, that a simple change in worldview. And I felt so much more connected to the universe and to the world. Anyway, I have this song that we're going to play that, gosh, I think I wrote the melody all the way back then, and then later discovered a poem by Robert Louis Stevenson that I thought fit it perfectly. And it, I think it's really describes how I felt at the time.
Do you hear this?
Said, when Peter told me that he didn't believe in the church, I completely fell apart. And for the next 3 days, I sobbed and sobbed. I remember calling Peter the next day while he was at work and saying, I think maybe we need to separate. Because what I had been taught my whole life is that you didn't lose your testimony unless you'd done something bad, unless you were doing something wrong. And I'm thinking, I don't know what he could be doing. He comes home every night, you know. He's like with me and the kids all the time when he's not at work. His time's accounted for, but something's up. And I, and
what's he doing at LDS family?
And I just fell apart. And then I couldn't talk to anybody because I knew that Peter was. I still believe Peter was a good person. I loved him. And if I told people they didn't believe in the church, they were going to judge him. And I didn't want that to happen. And so there was no one to talk to. And finally, I thought, well, I can talk to my sister-in-law because she's one of the most wonderful people you'll ever meet. Someone who would never tell a secret to someone. And somebody that I knew she believes absolutely in the church, but somebody that seems to love people no matter what. And so I called her and I was sobbing and I told her. And she said, Mary, she said, you need to remember that Peter is a good man. She said, I don't understand this either, but he's a good man, and you have to stay with that. You got to, you know, that's the first thing you've got to remember is he's a good man. And I'm so grateful she's the one I called, because I think if I'd called somebody else that would have backed up my hysteria, our story could have had a very different ending because I was completely irrational. And then a couple days later, I had my own revelation. I had gone into the bathroom to sob because my two little kids really didn't need to see me sobbing anymore. And I was praying, and I just had this overwhelming feeling come to me that Peter needed to be able to make his own choices and that everything was going to be okay. And I didn't, it wasn't that I knew that he was ever going to come back to church, but it was this overwhelming peace that it's okay. And Peter needs to be free to make his own choices. And it wasn't that everything was smooth after that, but it wasn't a question of whether I was going to end our marriage or,
We did, I think, enter an incredibly difficult 4 years where we were on opposite sides of this faith dilemma. I was so touched by one of the people who spoke in the open mic about their experience. And I was more capable of dealing with all the pain of this than I had ever been before. And then when Mary and I were talking about it, she was telling me how deeply painful those years were for her. It's so hard to be in love across this incredible gap in beliefs. And I continually marveled and was often very angry about how impossible it was to be on the same page with anything, how impossible it was for Mary to understand what was going on with me, and particularly frustrated because I felt like I was a better person than I'd ever been. And at the same time, precisely that was causing her this intense pain. So this is a song that I've loved for a long time, but that really speaks to me now about being in love and being separated. And anything?
Change his color white. If
And I think above anything else, the real triumph in our story is that we managed to stay together those 4 years. I realized there was no way I could step away from full participation in activity in the LDS church without hurting her incredibly. So I made a decision to stay. And she likewise, I think, made a decision to let me be who I was. And we worked on that for quite a while. I decided that I wasn't going to be able to stay if I couldn't find some way to have a sense of spirituality and participate, but be honest to myself. So some of you may be familiar with, it used to be called the Fair Boards, associated with the Fair website. I think it's a... The Mad Discussion Board now, an appropriate name change. But I got on there, and I think for 2 years, I just spent tons of time dialoguing, trying to see just how I could fit in the church, and it was nice because I could be anonymous and I didn't have to worry about anybody being too upset, and working on how to express my spirituality. And what I discovered was that a lot of what I had to say, a lot of that seminary teacher desire, that teacher in me, really came out. I think I found ways to express concepts that were deeply healing and moving to people within Mormonism that I had gained from without. I was sort of importing them from outside now. And so that was an interesting and rewarding time.
Sometimes. Sometimes people would just tell you off.
Well, that's true. I did get told I was evil a lot. But and in the meantime, we had a really lucky scenario in that we both loved music, and our callings were as musical missionaries in the orchestra at Temple Square. And so we were able to do that together. It was something I felt comfortable with. But increasingly, as the church got more political, I started having a real hard time representing the organization and feeling more and more at conflict. I remember when Proposition 3, the change to the Constitution here in Utah, banning gay marriage, went through, I was just furious and didn't know what to do, though. And on a whim, I answered the phone one day. I guess I was in a little fit of pique. I said, Danzig residents, vote no on 3 Levan headquarters. There was a huge pause, and I thought, what have I done? And then the voice of the first counselor in the bishopric stammering out, Brother Danzig, the bishop wants to know if you'll speak in church. Another pause, and then on building spirituality through families. Which we took the assignment. It was the last talk I ever gave in church, strangely enough. And it included some quotes from Angels in America and... But they were meaningful. You know, there are Mormons and Jews in Angel America. I'm just all over this. I eventually, though, when the letter was read over the pulpit asking us to write to our senators in support of the federal marriage amendment, I thought, this has, I absolutely can't support this. And I felt like I had a real out as a citizen of America. I had a right to voice my opinion separate from my religious convictions, because I understood arguing against the theology was not something I could do and be a member in good standing. But I said, I have a right and a responsibility as a citizen of the United States to say this is not how we ought to interact with our country. It's not our right to decide what people of other faiths do. So I wrote a series of letters in opposition to that to all the newspapers I could find in the area, and immediately got called in by the orchestra president and told that the First Presidency was extremely concerned that an enemy had infiltrated the orchestra. I'd never thought of myself as an infiltrator. But I tried to reassure them. I said, no, but I do have concerns about how gay people are treated in our church. And I do have concerns about some of the things that have happened in our church surrounding this. And but primarily my concern is, as a citizen, this does not, that we believe in the inspired, we believe in letting all men worship where, how, and what they may. I really made an appeal. It was my Mormon background, really, that had inspired me to do this. But I was told they didn't have a term for it. I don't think they'd ever suspended someone from the orchestra before, because they didn't have a term for it. They just said, you can't play until this is resolved, and we'll go back and report to the First Presidency and find out if your membership is in jeopardy. So I went home pretty upset. Mary, for her part, I think, thought that I had, because I was much more open with her, thought I had gone in and mouthed off to them. so she didn't really believe me. She thought it's, oh, it's all your fault, Peter.
Yeah, well, but so I wrote a letter to them, you know, trying to explain, you know, people have different points of view, and Peter, you know, he's not an enemy, and they wouldn't respond. They would not respond in writing at all. And finally we requested a meeting so we could, because we couldn't even find out what he was supposed to do to resolve this. And they set up a meeting with the president of the orchestra manager, which is just a paid employee. I mean, had no priesthood authority whatsoever. And then our bishop and our stake president. And we were living down in Levan, Utah at this point, so we're 100 miles south in this town of 850 people. So they decided we're going to meet halfway in between in Provo in a hotel room. And which was just bizarre. And we sat there for 2 hours. And in those whole 2 hours, when they first started, they said, we want you to know we love you. And then for 2 hours, they never once said, we hope we can resolve this. We can't wait for you to come back and play in the orchestra. We had played in the orchestra from the very first rehearsal. We had been in the orchestra, and it was so important to us. I had been so grateful when the orchestra was formed, because I had been taught my whole life, you can't go be a musician. You're going to be a mother in Zion. And yet my dream was to be a musician. And so this was like an answer to my prayer that I could go play in something without feeling guilty or feel like I was ruining my kids. And so this was really important to me. And for 2 hours, they just kept saying that Peter was in direct opposition to the brethren, that he was trying to destroy the church, that he was trying to make the brethren look bad. And, I mean, like, the orchestra manager, we played for his mother's funeral. Like, he specifically asked Peter and I to come and play. These are people I thought knew us. Our bishop, his wife was my best friend. And I couldn't believe that they could sit there for 2 hours while I sobbed and not even ask me if I was okay and not even let Peter know that they loved him. I mean, it was like we had crossed a line. And once that line was crossed, we were no longer fellow citizens. And this was the beginning of the end for me. And for a year and a half, we tried to work it through on every level of church authority. And what I found over and over is that once you've crossed a line, they don't care. Unless you want to come groveling back. That was my distinct impression, that they wanted Peter to come grovel and say that he'd been wrong. It wasn't. Peter could say, well, maybe I didn't phrase it correctly. You know, I didn't mean to be rude. You know, I'm sorry if I was rude. But that wasn't enough. He had to change his opinion. And he couldn't do that. And as I saw this, and I had also agreed with what Peter wrote in that letter, because I also didn't agree with the church being involved with the federal marriage amendment. That is what made me lose my testimony. I mean, I was one of these people that could reconstruct church history and make it metaphorical, and I didn't even care if the Book of Mormon was real or not because there were things in it that had touched me. But as I went through this, I started to realize that we weren't the only ones, that they hurt people. And it was one thing for me to go along with a system that was kind of magical and mystical and maybe not true, but it was another thing to actually face the reality that this was devastating people's lives. And for me, I thought religion was supposed to be about goodness and kindness, and that was nowhere to be found.
Right. You know, leaving the church was difficult in one other way, is that I had spent years collecting Mormon folk songs, and all of a sudden thought, where's the audience for this? But this one, I think, really speaks to this scenario. It's about a colorful character in Mormon history, Porter Rockwell, and I think it speaks very well to the dilemma we found ourselves in.
Have you heard of Porter Rockwell? He's a Mormon trigger eye. They say he hunts starless thieves when the moon is set and bright. So if you saw on Porter Rockwell, or he'll get the drop on. They say that Porter Rockwell is a scout for Brigham Young. He's hunting up the unsuspects who haven't yet been hung. That Porter Rockwell is the fist of the Danites. They're right across the countryside and take their foes by night. So if you cross the Mormon boys, I'll tell you what to do. Get to drop on Porter Rockwell. Though he calls himself an angel, he's the devil in disguise. When he saddles up his sorrow and he begins to ride. So if you hear the hoofbeats near, I'll tell you what to do. Get the drop on Porter Rock. Or he'll get the drop on you.
Thanks. So that's kind of what it felt like, you know. It felt like your friends had turned into Porter Rockwell and were hunting you down. And you know, the sad thing is that really the men that that I felt so hurt by are basically good, decent people. But once they felt ordered to do something, it's like the thinking stops. And and I had to look at it and realize how poorly I had treated Peter when he had let me know that he didn't have a testimony, and how much time it had taken me to realize that somebody could have not have a testimony, and it didn't mean they were a bad person. And he was my husband. I had the most reason to be invested, and so it made me realize what this organization can do to people's thinking. And But it's kind of funny because, you know, Peter had to be suspended from the orchestra because Lord
my
knows.
Temple recommend.
Yeah, he wasn't worthy of a temple recommend. And you just can't trust a violist in the orchestra to not do something wild, you know, in the middle of it. But there was one calling they weren't concerned about him continuing to do.
Yeah, I was the primary chorister. The bishop told me, yeah, but you can't do any harm there.
And little did he know that Peter has this knack for changing the words to things.
Well, I toyed with it anyway. I'll give you a few cute little primary songs that we... Our prophet has some words for you, and these are the words, revenue. Joseph loved his wives to see, he would count them quietly. 1, 2, 3, let me see, how many more can there be? 33, 34, who can know for sure if he lived instead of dying, he would have had more. Oh, and of course, one of our favorites. The primary colors are 1, 2, 3, white, and white. And there's always Nephi's courage, one of my favorites. I will go, I will kill the ones the Lord commands. I know the Lord provides the way, he wants me to go slay. A child's prayer. Let's see if I can remember this one. Heavenly Mother, are you really there? And if you are, and if you are, why can't I say your name in prayer? Some say that you won't answer me, but I would like to try once just to see. Oh, and my very favorite. Prophets will follow if they will pay. Prophets will follow. Joseph showed the way. Anyway.
So, yeah. But Peter kept telling me he was going to do these in primary. He said they were primary inoculation hymns, and that it was better for the kids to just get it the way it was from the beginning. They'd get used to it, and then it wouldn't be some giant shock when they got an internet when they got older. But he ended up deciding to resign his calling, that if they didn't think he was worthy of a temple recommend and they didn't think he should play in the orchestra, he really shouldn't be around their children.
I couldn't see how it was safe. for any of us. Well, I was asked repeatedly to apologize, and I wrote several apologies, and what I would usually do is say, I'm really sorry, it seems like I've really stepped over the line here and said something offensive, and here's what I was concerned about, and naturally you could understand I might be concerned. That part always ended, I got rejected every time, because what I had to do to get back in good graces was write a good apology, and so if I explained what I was worried about, it wasn't an apology all of a sudden. Well, being a musician, I thought, maybe I'll try a hymn.
Yeah, when you hear this, you'll see why he could never clear an apology.
Anyway, so we'll hope you enjoy this. It's a hymn that I wrote.
I'm building a bomb for Jesus to keep all his followers free. Some in other lands just don't understand. So I'm building a bomb for Jesus. For Jesus wants an army of those who will do his will. He has no hands but our hands to kill those whom Jesus would kill. I'm waterboarding for Jesus. protecting his nation from harm. When those terrorists squeal, it's because of my zeal. So I'm waterboarding for Jesus.
For Jesus wants an army of those who believe in his might. He has no hands but our hands to torture those terrorists right. I'm covering statues for Jesus. The spirit of justice needs clothes. Her bare marble breast caused my mind such unrest. So I'm covering statues for Jesus. For Jesus wants an army, chaste and modest and true. He has no hands but our hands to cover up the statue. I'm fighting the gays for Jesus because of their perverted ways. They want to be free to marry like me, so I'm fighting.
For Jesus, 'cause Jesus wants babies to live. But once they are born, they're not my concern. I'm not feeding babies for Jesus. For Jesus wants an army. Make sure all of the fetuses live. But once they're born, they're his concern. I've given all I can give.
Bible for Jesus, but one thing has got me confused. The people he sees, with whom he's not pleased, all seem to be people like me. For Jesus needs an army to educate people like me. He'll have no hands but your hands, 'cause I'm just too busy.
Building a barn for Jesus to keep all his followers free. Some in other lands just don't understand. So I'm building a barn for Jesus.
Well, needless to say, that didn't get me out of trouble. Although I thought it was very well encapsulated my sentiments.
Well, eventually we were told that if we talked about what the discipline that happened, I think they felt pretty embarrassed about once it had gone on for a while. And they said that if we ever talked beyond our immediate family about what had happened, that we would be disciplined. And for me, that was the final straw. I'd kind of been trying to hang on in some way because all my family was LDS. I didn't want to get left out of all the weddings. I didn't really believe in it anymore, but wanted to some way still be part of it in some way that wouldn't exclude me from everything. But I realized that that was a price I was not going to pay. That when an organization will tell you that you cannot tell what happened to you, and still be part of them, it was time to leave. And also, the other thing is that when we would tell people what had happened to us over the course of time, and we were pretty quiet about it, but when we did tell people, everybody always had a horrible story to tell us about something that had happened to them in the church, a bishop or stake president or somebody that had done something really awful to them. And so the other thing I realized, it wasn't just us, that this system is set up for abuse to happen. And I felt like I couldn't be quiet. people need to speak up because people are getting hurt. And it was one thing for them to just think weird, crazy things, but when you start to realize that this, like, ruins people's lives, I couldn't go there. So anyway, we resigned our membership December of 2007, and we moved up to Salt Lake. It didn't really seem feasible to live in a town of 800 people, LDS people, with three small children and think that they were going to be able to have a very normal childhood. And then eventually a reporter from the Salt Lake Tribune kind of got word of what had happened, and we ended up, our story came out. And so it was a really painful couple years. And the church responded, actually, with an official statement that was full of inaccuracies and basically tried to make us look like liars. They lied. Well, they said that the first presidency's office had not been involved, which we know is not true. We were repeatedly told from the get-go that the first presidency's office had asked. Now, we don't know specifically who beyond the secretary of the first presidency, but we know that the office was involved. They told us that we were lovingly counseled for 18 months. They wanted us to go away, honestly. We met 8 times. Some of those meetings included just me or just Peter. So a total of 8 meetings with one or both of us over 18 months. And we made the majority of those appointments because they didn't want to talk to us. They just wanted us to go away if we weren't going. And so lovingly counseled. And maybe that was loving counsel. Maybe I'm just a little bitter.
I think they were trying to give us space.
And they really ripped on the reporter who had let them know everything that was going to be in that article before it came out, and acted like she had been unprofessional, like she hadn't given them a chance to respond, which was not true at all. And that, for me, was the final kick in the pants on the way out.
I had gone to great pains to try and make sure the church knew everything we were releasing, everything I had seen. I asked them to check my facts because I didn't want to misrepresent anyone. So it was disappointing. But it was nice, too, because they made it very clear that we hadn't done anything wrong. We just had a difference of opinion. And I thought, well, that's probably a good thing for some people to hear, that you could have a difference of opinion and you might resign over it. And I think since then our life has just been unfolding at record clip. I can't believe how much we've done in that time. And it seems like every little while we go on, I start seeing new things in the world. We both have a song that we found really early on our journey out. We came up to a concert of David Wilcox and heard this song that he sang at the very end by Peter Mayer. I think it encapsulates my sense of spirituality. I'd have to describe myself like Bill Lobdell did on the atheist side of it. I don't know what's out there, and I think I have lots of ideas, and I want to keep them ideas because ideas are much more tractable than beliefs, let me just tell you. But I still have a very keen sense of spirituality and holiness, and I think this song really speaks to that. When I was a boy each week, Sunday we would go to church, pay attention to the priest. He would read the holy word, consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything is holy now.
When I was in Sunday school, we would read about the time Moses split the sea in two. Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad. The miracles don't happen still. But now I can't keep track, 'cause everything's a miracle. Everything's a miracle.
Wine from water is not so small.
But an even better magic trick, is it anything is here at all? So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but finding where there isn't one.
When holy water was rare and fast, barely wet my fingertips.
Now I have to hold my breath like I'm swimming in a sea of air. Everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. Read a questioning child's face. Say it's not a testament. That'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come. Say it's not a sacrament. Tell you that it can't be done.
This morning outside I stood. I saw a little red-winged bird. She was shining like a burning. Singing like scripture verse made me want to bow my head. I remembered when church let out how things have changed since then. Cause everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. Everything, everything, everything is holy now. Holy now. Everything is holy now. Used to be a world half fair, heaven second rate hand me downs. But I walk it with a reverent air. Everything is holy now. Everything is holy now. Oh, everything is holy.
Thank you. Well, it's been quite a journey, and it was a very painful journey, but I would take it all again and a lot more to end up where I am now. I didn't know my life could be so full of color, and it's great. It's great. There's so many possibilities, and I don't feel guilty now. I love my girls, and I spend a lot of time being a mom, but I don't feel guilty for having my own interests and my own dreams, which is great. One thing we've been doing a lot since we left is a lot of activism. I don't know, we felt so alone when we were going through our experience, and we would even have people that would say, we love you, we support you, we think this is terrible, but they wouldn't say it in any sort of public way in general, and that was really, really hurtful. And when I realized what they would do to my family just because Peter stood up for gay rights in a little bit, I realized, what are they doing to gay people? And I didn't feel like I could be quiet anymore. It's not okay. I know something about pain now, and it's not okay to leave people in that kind of pain and just sit back and think, well, that's too bad. So we, last year we helped Andrew Callahan with the Signing for Something petition, and then this year we ended up getting involved with the Foundation for Reconciliation, which is two straight Mormon women in California, one who's still active in the church, who decided that they needed to bring attention to what's happening. And so they thought, well, we're going to make a petition and we're just going to ask church to apologize for the teaching and practices that have been hurtful. And actually, it's a reasonable request. And some people say, well, they don't apologize, right? And we're like, yeah, actually, we do know that. So we're not delusional. Now, if they surprised us, that we'll take that, I guess. But really, the point of asking for an apology is more to have an opportunity to raise awareness. Because people say, well, why should they apologize? And it gives you an opportunity to explain. And so in the last few months, we've had a benefit concert to raise awareness about gay homeless youth. 42% of the kids in Salt Lake who are homeless are gay, been thrown out of their homes when they come out to their parents. So we had a benefit concert and raised $3,000 for that. And then we had a memorial service last Sunday to remember LGBT, LDS, people who have committed suicide. It's an epidemic in our state. We have the highest suicide rate of males between 15 and 24 in the nation. And I'm absolutely certain that that has a great deal to do with how homosexuality is treated in our
state. This is a really important issue because, like with us, the issue of orientation, everybody has somebody in their family that they're going to meet, find out, or well, they have them already and they don't know. And I think this is going to take a terrible toll on the church if they don't find some way to deal with it more skillfully, because it's so painful to watch family members suffer. And we've seen an incredible outpouring of support for this effort. Some of you, if you want to see our video, Will Swenson, some of you may remember him from the Mormon movie scene, filmed a video for us along with a friend of his, Peter Brown. And we are actually, our final event for the year is we're going to be delivering the petition, a memorial book of the suicide tour documented. We've done a questionnaire about amounts of time and talents and money donated to the church by LGBT members, their allies, and friends. And we're going to be bringing all of this in a hand cart. We're trekking from This Is a Place State Monument down to church headquarters. We were really inspired when Gene Robinson came through town and said, use your faith. Don't abandon who you are, your faith, or where you came from in order to be activists here. And we thought, you know, there 24% of self-described Mormons disagree with the church's stance on homosexuality, according to Pew Forums. With that, this is an area where we can do an incredible amount of good for society and for those people who are still inside the church. So if you, any of you are interested, we'd love to have you come to our events. We'd love to have you log on and look. We're running out of money, so if anybody has money they'd like to donate, LDSapology.org is the website. You can sign the petition. You can come to an event. You can watch the video. You can forward the video on to your friends and neighbors. Let me tell you what it is again, LDSapology.org. Delightfully ambiguous, isn't it? Everyone thinks we're apologists. And they go there hoping to find answers.
And boy, do they find answers.
So, but it's been a wonderful journey. Well, this last song is another one of those Mormon folk songs that I've carried along in our, we've carried in our repertoire even leaving. It's about the railroad coming to Utah, and it's a delightful verse. I toned it down from the original. The original version ends with them saying, saints will come, and then a derogatory term for black people too. The Great Union Railroad will bring the devil through. I think we have the same thing happening today, only it's a different group of people who are looked at as next to the devil. But there's an awareness growing. The railroad brought tremendous changes to Utah. And the interesting thing is that the other half of this song, the Saints were thrilled that the railroad was coming. It was exciting. I think our new railroad is the internet. You can't hide things on the internet. And it's bringing everything through, and you just can't miss it anymore. You can't sweep it under the rug. So, hope you enjoy this last tune.
Before we play it, I'll just put a plug. We've been working on a CD, and our full-length CD isn't finished, but we have a CD preview. Which includes Building a Bomb for Jesus, which won't be on the CD, but we thought some of you might want that. So we have our CD preview. It has 6 songs, 4 that will be on the CD and 2 that won't, for $5. And if you want to buy one today, we'll give you $5 off when our real CD comes out, if you just remind us that you bought it at the Ex-Mormon Conference.
That's right, yes, and it has 3 of the songs we sang, and there'll be a few of the others. Everything except Holy Now and Building a Bomb for Jesus will be on the actual CD. So if you want Building a Bomb for Jesus, get it today or write to us. Okay, anything else?
No.
Okay.
Do you have a website? Oh, yes, we do have. Okay, we go by Otter Creek when we perform. So
this is Mary's feminist streak, so her last name is Swedish for Otter Creek.
Uh-huh. Otterstrom translates to Otter Creek. So I told Peter that, yeah, I took your name, but if we're ever famous, they're going to know you by my name. So anyway, if you want to look up our website, it's www.ottercreekduo.com. And we're also
on Facebook too. So. You can look us up, be our friends.
We always need friends.
Whistles loud, clear the route, for the iron horse is coming with the steam in his snout. Build him roads to come on, make them level for the run. Dig tunnels through the mountains, turn the currents of the thousand through the fill stations. Lay the track he will take, for the iron horse is coming with the train in his way. Passes by and the iron horse draws nigh. We'll raise our flags and rally with loud shouts and shout like valley when it comes through our land. Let us all be on hand to mount the cars together like a proud, happy band. Iron horse, mighty speed, o'er the plains, let him speed, until he brings the blessings and the counts of all the ocean drink will come to his feet. Of all he can do for the great new railroad will bring the devil free.
Oh, thank you very much.
Rob some time out of our mic time to have questions if anyone has any for the Danzigs. So what are you doing for a living these days?
Oh.
Peter is a social worker still. So that's how we survive mostly. I teach some violin lessons and we do a few gigs, but if we tried to live in our music right now, we would be really hungry.
It's just slightly better than living on activism.
David Leek online has a question for you asking, did you build your things as a dulcimer?
No, I bought it, but I've thought of building one, so maybe someday. Well, so I was an intern there, and I don't think I was a particularly well-liked intern. It was a very difficult year for me because, on the one hand, I felt like I did have a really unique understanding of Mormon culture and Mormon doctrine, and that a lot of people who were, even before I left the church, I was very clear that a lot of people are deeply wounded by a harsh understanding of God. And I had spent my life working on a way to resolve that for myself. I mean, my imagery as a child was that every knee shall bend and every tongue confess. I imagined the angels there with a whip. And it wasn't until I was much older that I realized that maybe another meaning of that could be that everybody would be so blessed and moved that they would. It took me forever to realize that, and I knew there were other people, so I loved working with people that way. And on the other side, I attended a, they used to volunteer a therapist for an Evergreen Friends and Family group, and I went to one of those. I was horrified because they were just reinforcing all these completely inaccurate stereotypes. There were parents there who'd been going to that group for 2 or 3 years who thought they shouldn't, that their grandchildren were in danger of being molested by their gay son. And so I piped right up and dispelled all these notions and then got in big trouble. So
Peter didn't seek full-time employment after, by the time he finished his internship, he knew that Elders Family Services was not going to be a good fit.
That's true.
So as a good little Mormon boy, I remember a lot of these musical and talk tapes that people would do. Are you going to turn your story with the music into a CD that people can
get? We hadn't thought of that.
Please do it. Well, thank you. We'll give that some thought. Anything else?
Could you tell us a little bit about your father? You mentioned a little bit about some of the things that he went through. I've read your history, and I understand it a little bit, but maybe some of the other folks here would be interested in that.
Oh, it's such a long story. I'll try and give a really brief summary. He was head of maintenance at the vault.
At the Granite Vault.
Yeah, the church's locked-up vault up in the canyon. And Sam Weller? Is that who it was? Had an agreement with the church that if any sensitive materials came into their possession, the church got the first call and could buy it. And so I think it was John Taylor's diary showed up on microfilm there. The church bought it, and they were immediately concerned, how did this get out? Somebody's mind leapt immediately to, it must have come from the vault. And they looked at the vault and said, there are only 3 people who have the combination, and Peter Danzig's the only one smart enough to have pulled it off. So they suspended him immediately without pay. Well, no, with pay, but his office was cordoned off and all his belongings in there confiscated, and he was told to go home. Don't talk to your wife, don't speak to your bishop or anyone else about what's going on, or you could be excommunicated. The investigation lasted, I think, 7 months.
After 2 days, they knew he hadn't done it.
Yeah, 2 days in, the person analyzing the microfilm said, this is a 5th-generation copy, and the copy in the vault is a 1st-generation copy. It didn't come from there. I don't know for sure. It's a long, long story, and he has chosen not to share it himself. He's still a faithful member. So But one that I think it was traumatic for our family, and he was eventually kind of shoved out of employment. And his dream was to work for the church, and he applied for all these positions. And as soon as he applied, then all of a sudden they needed a degree that hadn't been listed. And same thing happened to me with a couple of positions I applied for at the church. And then so in the back of my mind, when I was trying to become a seminary teacher and it suddenly didn't happen, I kind of thought, oh, I think I've hit a wall. So.
When did that happen?
When did what happen?
With your dad. So Peter was turning 8.
Oh, yeah, this is interesting. From a psychology perspective, I was just about turn 8 when this happened to my
dad.
About
1980?
And it was really traumatic for our family. If you can imagine, dad comes home and everybody's, because a lot of church employees lived in our neighborhood, everybody's whispering, something's wrong with Peter. He may be excommunicated. But he can't tell my mom a word about it. She was panicked. So it was, and our experience actually ended up happening right when my oldest daughter was 7. So it was kind of an interesting revisiting of my childhood. But, go ahead.
Well, I can't tell you how impressed I am with you, beautiful young couple here. I'm curious. Quite a few of us have developed a sensitivity and a tolerance and an appreciation for gay people because of a family member. My own daughter is gay, and in coming to terms with that, we realized so many of the feelings that you folks have expressed. Do you have an experience like that with friends or family, or was it just a sense of social conscience and rightness that brought you to the idea of activism on behalf of these people?
Well, ironically, I think it's my faith that brought me to that. I have no relatives in my family that are openly gay. I have my suspicions, but my father raised me with a very intense Jewish identity, which you can do in Mormonism because it's cool to be Jewish too. And then I went on a mission to Germany. And the weirdest thing is that Germans could look at me and look at my last name and they'd say, "You're Jewish, aren't you?" And it's, which was very odd. And I had always asked myself, what would I have done if I lived in Germany, didn't need to be in trouble, but saw my neighbors getting carted off? This was a question that had come to me over and over. And so when I started reading personal stories and science about homosexuality, I realized that my neighbors were being carted off. And this was the moment I had to decide what I was going to do. So, I don't know if you want to say anything.
Well, I do have a cousin who's gay, and I haven't seen him in many, many years. Because when I was a teenager, he left the state and said he was never coming back. And kind of came out at that point. He was the kind of big cousin that played with all the little kids, you know, that kind. And very gentle, very sweet. And I think that kind of left my heart open to things more, because I knew when I heard he was gay, I knew that being gay didn't mean you were bad, because there was no one in this world that was going to convince me my cousin was bad. But I kind of put it on a shelf for a long time, so...
There's a huge following for Western U.S. music, and the Brits don't like Mormons much anyway. Peter, immediately after that, Nunlock was wondering, what tribe was your patriarchal blessing from?
Well, so we'll go to England if you get us a gig and a way over and a place to stay. Yeah, tomorrow if you want. Judah, no, Ephraim. But I was, interestingly enough, I think it was worded oddly. I was assigned to Ephraim or something weird like that instead of descended from.
Test one.
Peter, what's your sense of the gap between the services provided by church social services and social services in the real world?
First, let me say there are many competent therapists at LDS Family Services. So, and then there, I think, are people who choose to go there because they would have difficulty functioning outside of that setting because of their religious beliefs. So, honestly, there are bad therapists everywhere. And if anyone here, therapy is a wonderful tool, and if anyone here feels like they would like to use that tool, I encourage you to be very assertive. Find a therapist that meets your needs and that's safe. Because I would say there are things that worry me deeply. I talked about them, about LDS Family Services, but there are also some very affirming, wonderful therapists kind of hidden among the flock there too. So pick carefully. So.
Might say that there's kind of an obsession with, like...
Oh, there was an obsession with pornography addiction. And we didn't treat addiction except for pornography addiction because nobody knew how to treat addiction. Except for pornography addiction. They actually produced a... I'm going to have to... I apologize for taking time because I really want to hear everybody else's story. But they did produce a video, I remember, while I was there to train us how to treat pornography addiction. And the end scenario, the therapist sitting in the room with Bob. Bob, I want you to imagine that you're surfing the net, looking at that filthy pornography. And then you realize that behind you is your wife, your dear wife, and your daughters. Bob, what are you feeling? Oh, and I mean, addiction, if anyone struggles with addiction, is driven by shame. And I was just horrified. I was just horrified at this treatment modality that they had come up with.
How did they acquire their expertise?
I don't know. But, so anyway, thank you very much. I want to hear your stories because they were so inspiring the first night. I thought, what are we doing spending so much time talking about ours? If you do want one of our CDs, they're up front. They're $5. You can leave the money on the table. You can give it to us, whatever you like. Thanks.